Hey everybody, I'm John Shires. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, it's great to be here with you guys tonight. So I'm going to introduce our speaker tonight. What's his name?
Scott.
Scott. Oh, what's his name? You're going to love him.
He's
so anonymous, man. So anonymous. I met Scott today, okay? But a friend of mine said, I'm the speaker chair for my home group, and so I put, feelers out, hey, let me know if you hear good speakers. And a friend of mine in Florida texted me a link to a talk that Scott had given, and so I thanked him. I listened to it one day driving to work. I was like, I love Scott. And we've been hanging out for one day, and just like it happens in AA, you get to know people like that. You're telling your deepest, darkest secrets. You're telling insane stories. The thing I love about Scott, he's just got so much enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's my kind of people. So without any further ado, here's Scott.
My name's Steve, I'm an alcoholic. No, I'm just kidding.
Damn it.
Scott Fleming, alcoholic.
Scott.
Thank you very much for the kind invitation to come out here and share a little of me with you tonight, and you with me. I thank my creator for allowing me to be here with you sober today and didn't think of a drink all day. And it's a miracle for a guy like me. I had a great time, hanging out with everybody before I got here, having dinner. And, just the fellowshipping. And, I love saying that we're going to meet friends that we just haven't met yet, And that's how it was when I got here and got to meet all of you. And thank you for hosting and, Claire and... John, and it's just been Katie and Kathy, and coming and talk to Amy and hear all she's doing. So it's amazing to be here. I can already feel the spirit here, and I feel at home. Didn't always feel that way. Didn't always feel at home here, which is strange because or anywhere actually, because I come from a really good family. My mother and father are the most non-judgmental, loving people I have ever met. I never heard my mother or father say one derogatory comment about another human being. Man, and I love them for that. And I thank them for that. But even in this, and my upbringing wasn't perfect. It wasn't perfect. They had their issues, but like the things you needed as a child, right, were there. Education, big focus on education. My mother's a teacher. I was a D-minus student my whole life. My father was a Vietnam vet who lost his leg in the war, and he worked hard and battled, depression and anxiety, which I know is real because I've witnessed that. He would be a dead man, 100% without medications, suicidal, and so I know that's real, and I would watch my father, but these are good people, My brother is a year and a half younger than me. He lives a balanced, honest, fair life. I don't know how he does it, He's always done it. My sister's 10 years younger. Not that they don't have their issues, I'm sure, but they don't react the way I react to life or to booze. And for me... I look back, and the moment my brother was born, I can look back on it and see that I had to have been jealous. I had to have been, I just know that from when I can, my earliest memories was I would beat that kid down. Beautiful boy. I beat him down. I put my hands on him. I called him despicable names, right, because I didn't measure up. And he was my easiest target to puff myself up. And I would carry that shame for a long time. I carried that right into Alcoholics Anonymous. And at times, late in my drinking, as he was going off to, not late, but as he's going off to school, and I'm crying because I want to say something to him. As he goes off, I'm so sorry the way I treated you, Will, my whole life, but I couldn't. And I'm drinking, and drinking. And these are the things I have to live with. But this is how I compensated for my, lack of being good enough, I guess, or whatever. I seem to suffer from an exaggerated ego, I think, which makes me very fearful in this world. 13 years old, booze comes into my life like it comes into anyone's life, And I don't know if I realized how disconnected I was from you and you know, the world until that night. Because as I drank booze and it went into my system, man, I was able to do things that I saw you guys do with ease, like talk to girls, you know, like feel like I belonged and people wanted me there. Like I just had this sense of power. You know, it also allowed me to, I think, feel superior to. And I would later find out that that's my real problem, right? And I like that. So for me, that first night of my experience with alcohol was profound. And booze that night became the most important thing in my life. I didn't drink it every day from that moment on because I couldn't. You know, I was 13, 14, 15. But I'll tell you this, I thought about it every day from that moment on. And the thoughts were like this: when can I get it again? Where's the keg this party this weekend in the woods? How can I get to know older guys that can get it for me? How can I get money, steal money, or how can I acquire money so I can get booze? So booze dominated my thinking from that moment, you know, until I came in here. And it felt like it was fun for a while. And I know it wasn't fun because I know what real fun is today. But it felt fun, and it allowed me to you know, be a popular kid in high school and be one of the party guys and all that stuff that I love, and I kind of ran with it. And I'm not a real good student, like I said, but I played a lot of sports. I played 4 sports in high school, and the one I excelled the most was tennis. And I was flown down to a school in North Carolina in my senior year, and to play in front of a coach. And what happened was they were in the regional finals, and it was an outdoor match, and it started to rain, so we had to go into the Raleigh Cricket Club. And while we're in there, one of the older guys on the team and I noticed that there was a wedding reception being set up, you know, and there was a keg there. And he said, "Why don't we steal this keg, put it in the bushes? I'll call my buddy to come get it, and we'll go back and drink later on." I said, "That sounds great." So we did that. And he came and got it, and he went back. He took it back, and we went back to the dorm, and we pretended like we were going to bed, and we snuck out. I drank all night as a senior in high school at this college, and I knew this was the college I wanted to go to. You know, so I fly home, and I graduate by the skin of my teeth. I almost had to go to summer school, just made it by. And in the summer, I go on this bender, right? And I'm hanging out at my friend's house, whose parents are gone, and I get arrested. So it's like the first time that I had real consequences. Now, I'm 18 years old. My mother and father already knew there was a problem with me and booze, because they saw it growing up, and they knew what it looked like and felt like, but I was not. So they've been bothering me to get help for about a year. I said, there's no way you're going to take away the one thing that makes me feel comfortable in my own skin at 18. No way. But I'm facing, you know, some charges here. I want to go to the school. I thought, you know what? If I go to rehab, the judge will be lenient on me. It'll look good, right? And then my mother and father, I would appease them. So I go into rehab at 18 years old just for drinking. No thoughts I'm going to stop. But while I'm in there, I'm listening to these old guys. They were old. They were like 30, 40 years old. You know, they were talking about things they lost that I was about to embark on, like a scholarship or an education or a career. Or the one guy was talking about how his kids, he hasn't seen them in a couple of years. The one guy said his mother and father died before they got to see him do anything with his life. I could feel the shame and remorse. It was palpable. I also identified with the way they drank, and I knew that booze was too important to me already. And I said to myself, I'm not going to drink anymore. I want to go away and make my mother and father proud. I want to take advantage of the scholarship, play tennis, get an education, and have a career. And I set off to do that. And I didn't drink for 29 days. The 30th day is when my parents dropped me off at that college and they drove away. And I had no idea what I was up against. I did not know I didn't have a defense against the first drink. I didn't know I didn't have a choice in the matter. I didn't know I had these mental blank spots. And I was sure that I wasn't going to drink. And I wouldn't have drank if I wasn't asked the wrong question that night. The guys on the tennis team came over and said, "You want some beer?" I said, "Yeah, give me a six-pack of Bud Pounders." Just like that. It reminds me of our history. When Hazard's with Young, you know, in 31, he's there voluntarily in Switzerland with the best doctor in the world. He's there voluntarily for a year, wanting to stop drinking, saying, "Doc, please help me, I'm all yours." And after a year, Dr. Young says, "You're good to go." And he drinks the next day on the way home in Paris. And he goes back to the doctor and he begs him, "Why did I drink? I thought you fixed me." Right? I had no idea what I was up against. I couldn't stop drinking that night. 4 a.m. in the morning, I'm calling my aunt on the phone crying. because I really deep down didn't want to drink, and I'm talking the stuff I learned in rehab to her. A phone call I'd be ashamed of for many years, right? And I come to the next day, and it was on. I couldn't stop. Within a year and a half, I was out of that school. I never played one match of tennis. You know, I'm 19 years old, and this is like where, for me, this is the cruel part of this thing. I thought I found magic, and now that's wearing off. And I'm no longer fitting in. I'm no longer, you know, talking to the girls. It's not letting me talk to girls. I'm antisocial. I'm all alone. I'm drinking more and more and more, and I can't get the effect. I'm lost. I'm confused, right? It's slipping away from me, I don't understand it. I have great parents, like I told you. I called my dad because, you know, the last semester, I couldn't even go to school and, you know, class. And I was suspended from the team. The dean also had me in his office, you know, and he was threatening to, you know, arrest me if I don't leave voluntarily. So that helped. But I was on the phone with my dad, and I was crying out for help in a way. And he said, come on home. I'll fly you home right now. And I got on that plane. I flew home, and I enrolled in the community college. I would have been the number one tennis player there. They have a great team. They go to nationals. But within 2 weeks or so, I can't go. I'm stopping off in the woods, drinking with the guys that drink like me. You know, in the next 10 years of my life, I live it meaningless and purposeless. I could tell you the war stories, you know. I mean, we all have them. But inside, it was a lonely existence, and I was very confused. And, you know, I would take my parents hostage through my 20s. Now, I have a sister I mentioned 10 years younger. And I love my sister. And when she was born and she came late in the game, I fell in love with her. You know, and I wanted to be that big brother. I taught her how to ride a bike, and I'd race home, you know, before alcoholism progressed. I'd go home and pick her up from the bus stop. And now alcoholism is progressing in me. I'm a monster in the house. I'm abusive. And she's grown up in her most important years around this. And they would beg me to leave, and I would leave. I took a hostage for 8 years. I used to say it was an ex-girlfriend. It was not an ex-girlfriend. It was a hostage situation. She loved me and cared about me. And I drug her through my alcoholic life and used and abused her. And she would always take me back. About a month or two before I came, or three or something, she cut me off. Like, completely. Like, I couldn't believe she severed everything. Didn't take any calls. Knocks on her door, nothing. Part of the reason why I'm here. But this is how I'm living. I can't hold a job. I don't know how people do it. I would get a job, progress quickly, let go for drinking, you know. Bouncing around on friends' couches, could never hold an apartment. I'd get a great job. I'd be making good money. I'd get an apartment, and then the lights were out, you know. I couldn't pay the utility bills with all the money I was making. Then the landlord's knocking on the door, you got to go. And I'm bouncing around, and I'm virtually homeless at times. And late in my 20s, I really thought I had schizophrenia. You know, I've been on some meds, man, ever since I can remember. My mother, like I said, is a teacher. She had me in front of guidance counselors, therapists, psychologists, my whole life. And I've been on something, like here and there. And I really thought I was schizophrenia. I'm here in front of a doctor, and I'm on meds. See, I'd rather it be you tell me I have schizophrenia than tell me it's the booze. Don't take away my best friend. I'm here to tell you I'm not schizophrenic. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I have a lot of friends that are. I had untreated alcoholism. You know, and there was a way up and a way up, but I didn't want you to tell me it was the booze. And in the end, I wanted to die. I didn't have the courage to take my own life, but I'll tell you this, I would come to in the morning disappointed. That I'd have to suffer through another day, the self-loathing, the degradation, the confusion, the loneliness. And for some reason, I don't know why. See, because that rehab will come to my mind often in my 20s, often. But this one night, for some reason, I drank like any other night. And I was with a friend, and she was telling me some things about me that I don't know, maybe it helped. And I woke up the next morning, and the realization of my life came to me. I was virtually homeless at this point. All I had was like a little 1986 car or something like that. That was it. And my mother said no. I just got evicted from a little studio I had that was like $500 a month. I couldn't even hold down. And for some reason, this all came crashing in on me, and I realized where I was in life. And that rehab, and I kind of cried out. I kind of cried out, and tears came down. And that rehab came to my mind again. And maybe the pain was great enough. And I made the phone call to that same rehab I was in 10 or 11 years prior, and they said, come on in. And I said, can I come in on Monday? Because it was Friday, you know. And they said, no, come on in now. And I guess, you know, I guess it was the pain was great enough. I went in. I didn't answer all the questions, honestly, because I didn't want inpatient. You know, I wanted outpatient. So I told them, you know, I didn't tell them everything I was doing. And they gave me outpatient, intensive outpatient. Now I'm back in this rehab, but I'm going 4 to 9 every night, Monday through Friday. I'm shot at and hit hurting from booze. And I feel safe in this place. And I'm doing everything they say to do, right? But there's one thing I don't want to do. They're telling me to make meetings. Like over the weekend, you got to make meetings. And there was a whiteboard. And it would be like, Susie made 5 at a clubhouse, you know, like 3. Bob made 2. Steve, Scott, 0. And every, like for 2.5, 3 weeks, it was 0, 0, 0. I didn't want to come here. I mean, I had been stipulated to be here when I was like 20 for DUI. And I remember it was a bunch of old guys commiserating. It was smoky. It was so smoky back then, you didn't have to worry about anonymity because you couldn't see anybody, you know? You could smoke in a meeting. I mean, I went in, like, for half a meeting, I left, and I had my friend who was in AA sign all my, you know, all my papers. This didn't seem like any fun to me. How could this be fun? And I couldn't imagine being around you guys without drinking. So I wasn't going to come here. But Dennis, the counselor, told me one day after saying 0, 0, 0, stay after, I'm going to talk to you. He said, if you don't make meetings, you can't be a part of this group. And I was afraid to not be a part of that group. I was afraid I would drink. So I was nudged into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked into the Greater Levittown group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which would become a home group for 10 years. Now, I did not know that night, but I sat on that back wall, scared to death, feeling like my life was over. But only like the dying could, I listened, you know. This is just my story, and if this isn't your story, you know, we could still be friends, but I've never been on a cell phone in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and I hope I never am. Standing here right now, this is life or death for me. I'm a desperate man still. And that night I was dying, and I wasn't having a good time there. But as I watched everything go on and I saw this person move around, and the chairperson, Deb G, who I later got to know, and she called up the speaker, and it was Larry A from a town next to me, and I listened to Larry, and as he spoke, the magic happened for me. A couple things. One, I drank exactly the way he drank. 2, he seemed reasonably happy without drinking now. And 3, most importantly, is I believed him. And I got hope instantly. And and after the meeting, I was surrounded by people because I put my hand up as the first time here. If you're new here, welcome. I hope you find what a lot of us have found here. And by the way, whenever I see Larry, I remind Larry, you're the first person I heard speak in AA. Thank you. And that means so much to him, but it means so much to me. And Tall Paul came up to me and shook my hand afterwards, first person. He's like 7 foot tall. I thank him for shaking my hand. And Paul's in and out. But that man has a big part of my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they invited me down into the basement because they play music and I don't play music. And I just was happy they invited me somewhere. And I fell in love with the Fellowship of AA that very night. And I have not fallen out of love with it. That's my experience. I know it's not everyone's. I know it because that night, as I left the meeting, I walked down the handicapped ramp, happy to be a part of AA, what I just found there. And Frank was walking up complaining about these meetings. He was like, oh, I guess if I go to these meetings, I'll stay sober. Frank, to this day, cannot stay sober. God bless him. I got in my little car. I went to my parents' house. Now, my parents couldn't be happier to have me live with them. You know, because I'm going to AA. I think my parents want me to live with them today. With what you have done with me. And I started going to AA every single day. I was out of my mind. I couldn't work. And I started going to, I got sober at a clubhouse, 9, noon, 5:30, 8, midnight. Meetings around the clock. In between the meetings, I'm talking to Nancy K with 35 years, one of my heroes in AA, just past reason. Love Nancy. Bob C, 45 years. He would hurt your feelings in the meeting. He hurt mine many times. Like, I feel like I was shared something dumb. But I got over that, and I appreciate that man sat there for 45 years, you know. And by the way, these people, like Bob C, was, you know, he wasn't a big book guy, but he was an AA guy. He was sober and he showed up. You know, Adam T, 42 years, called all the new guys cakes. You know what I mean? It was like one of those. It just made me feel good, and he took an interest in me. I took an interest in him. And when he passed, I was at his funeral. and I got to say a few words. Like, these are the long-timers, and a lot of them weren't into the big book, but these were the long-timers that were there for me when I went, and they actually loved me and cared about me and wanted me to succeed. And I mean, I did everything alcoholics asked me to do, every single thing, except for 12 things. And my life externally got so good so quick. You know, I don't, like I said, my mother is showing me off to the family 2 months sober. Look at our son, he's back. Look at his eyes, his skin. The girl, the ex-hostage, she's calling me. I heard you're sober. I couldn't get her to answer my... I'm like, I want to see you. I ran off to her and made that fake amends, you know? The one that she deserves when I get the 8, you know, and 9, and she got that. And but this is what's happening to me just because I'm coming here loving your fellowship. I'm in service, you know? I become the alternate... I started attending your business meetings, which were interesting, you know? I've been alternate integrate rep. The integrate rep drinks. I've become the integrate rep at 3 or 4 months sobriety for 2-year commitment. I'm in service at that level in AA. Right? I'm chairing meetings. I'm branching out to other meetings. I got a pocket full of guys' numbers. Guys' numbers. You know, we're going to the diners afterwards in the meeting. We're talking about the wonderful things that we heard in here and how our lives might change. I don't know what your dreams are. Maybe you have them. Maybe you don't. I have dreams. I've always had dreams. I won't apologize for that. Most importantly, my dreams were I've always wanted to be a good son, a good brother, a good friend, a good student, a good guy in the community. I could never be those things. Other dreams that weren't as important but were still dreams. I always wanted to travel the world. I don't know why, but since I was a kid, I was fascinated with globes and maps. And I never left my hometown. I never left the bar stool. I was too afraid to live. My mother worked hard. She's a teacher in the summers, traveled, saved her money. I hated her for it because she invited my brother and never invited me. My brother worked hard, saved his money. In fact, I hated anyone that had success. And I won't be that guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, I am your cheerleader. I hope your life goes wildly successful. You want to be a business person and make tons of money? I hope you do. I hope you come back and share about how good your life is. I hope you never forget this purpose, right? Your primary, my primary, and the what I'm doing in the third step. But all these other things, primary purpose suggests we have other purposes here. Right? And I start to find out what my gifts are, and I start to apply them really early. God gave me a mind for business. Right? So early on, you know, I'm doing all this stuff. Things were happening to me on the outside. My brother, 5 months sobriety, says, let's go to Ireland. Now, I have a business started because I'm now sober, and I'm applying the gifts that God gave me to my sober life, right, for good. I have another little, like, I make a good investment. I'm saving money. I start to learn about money. I'm making financial amends a little bit here and there. Like you know, and my brother says, let's go to Ireland. And after he asked me, I wasn't sure what to do in 5 months. All right? And I'm doing the literature in the closet of my clubhouse, and I come across this meeting list for all the meetings in Ireland. I thought, that's a sign to go. So we take this trip, and 6 months of sobriety, I fly for 10 days, and I get off at Shannon Island with my brother, and I knew right away it was going to be hard. Second day, I'm looking over the ring of curry. I'm thinking, why can't I have a few beers with my brother? Why can't I? Third day, I make a conscious decision. I'm going to drink before this is over. Now, I'm calling people back at my home group. I'm making meetings in Ireland, and I'm journaling about this drink, which I'm not a writer, and I can't get the drink off me. Fourth day in, I end up in a restaurant, and he orders a beer in Donegal, and I want to drink so bad it hurts. And I would have drank if it wasn't for my brother. But I already told you, I abused him my whole life, and he knew I was a sober member of AA. And I said to my brother, Will, I got to get out of here. And we left, and I went into my bed and breakfast, and I went into the bathroom, and I closed the door, and I paced in that bathroom. I didn't know what to do. But from paying attention in here, I did hear that at some point in your sobriety, the only thing between you and a drink will be God. Didn't sound like any fun to me, or, you know, like I didn't want to know what that was about, but I had no other choice. There I was in the bathroom. I dropped on my knees for the first time in my life. I said, God, I want to drink, but I don't want to drink. Please help me. And I didn't drink. But more than that, I got off my knees. I didn't want to drink anymore. That's the first time that ever happened to me. Since I was 13 years old, booze owned me. I was a slave to it. I answered the call every time it called me. Even in my late 20s, from 25 to 29, there'd be times where I'd wake up with my crappy life. See, I'd get like odd jobs of roofing and siding where my friends owned because I could call out whenever I wanted. So no Fridays, no Mondays, right? Or whatever. And I could just make some money, go drink. And I would walk to these dive bars on rainy days when there was no work, and I would sometimes cry. Like cry, like a baby. And I would wipe my tears off and I would go in and order my alcohol because I couldn't not drink. And now it's taken from me. I even flew to Scotland on my own. I ended up in Edinburgh. And I'm walking around 6 months sobriety, Edinburgh, alone. And the bar lights were flashing, which to me are the most attractive things in the world. Most comfortable things in the world. And there was no pull. There was no, I wish I could. I was free. I flew back to Dublin to meet up with my brother on a flight home. I'm now interested in your big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I had it with me. I wasn't doing much with it. And I had a guy named Jimmy Watt trying to sponsor me. He said to me, Scott, don't you think guys with 5 years need guys to sponsor to stay sober? I thought I'd do him a favor. He said, yeah, you can sponsor me. Yeah. And he's opening up the book down in the basement, taking it seriously. And I wasn't receiving the gift. Why? I am not a victim of Alcoholics Anonymous. I might have told you that before, but I'm here to tell you I'm not. I heard the message. If 99 guys in that clubhouse were saying, don't drink and make meetings and you're good to go, there was one guy who was talking about, if you want peaceful, contented, permanent sobriety, if you want to walk out these doors and want your life and not have alcohol hold you back, you got to take these steps. I was afraid. I was afraid, so I stayed away from that guy. I on the flight home, I open up the big book. It happens to be Weak Gnostics. The first lines my eyes see are, either God's everything or he's nothing, either is or isn't what your choice to be. And I knew that he is. And with that came this, I'll be okay as long as I depend on him, no matter what. That's all I ever really wanted in life was to feel okay. Booze came close, but it wasn't real. This was real. I knew what everything in my being. And this intuitive thought came to me with that feeling. It said, when you get off this plane, you better go see that man that you were attracted to but afraid of at the same time. His name was John Bragg. When John came in my home group, man, I loved it when he was there. When he shared, it came from somewhere deep. When he would speak, it was coming, you know, it was peaceful. And if there was tables in my home group that guys would be around them and the big book open, and I could tell in his eyes that he would rather be there than anywhere else in the world with them. And I didn't know what that was about, but I was curious, but I was also afraid of John because he could see right through me. And I wasn't taking your steps. I wasn't worthy. I had shame and guilt riddled with it. And if I told you the things that I did, you'd use it against me someday because I would do that to you. So I wasn't letting that guy near me, but I was also attracted to John. I knew I had to go see him. And I go back to my home group, and I would sit there, and he would sit there, and I kind of moved myself closer to him. You know, like after 2 weeks, I was like right next to him. And one day he said, you want me to sponsor you or something? I said, John, I never thought you'd ask. You know what I mean? It's like, that's like asking another man to be your Valentine. You know, it's not easy. And he picked up on that and he asked me and we began. And we began with our program, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that I'm the journey of the steps, which I'm still on today. And I started to do things with John that I could never have done on my own. Yeah, I just trusted him a little bit. You know, I came to that second step formally, and I said, John, I don't know if I'm worthy. You know, he goes, Scott, God wants you to be sober. You deserve to be sober. Let's take these steps and let's see what happens. And that was enough for me to say, all right, maybe. You know, we said the third step prayer, but before we did, on our knees, I knew what we were going to do. I heard stories about it. Didn't sound like a good idea to me, you know. We get down in the basement, and he explains me what I'm doing. You're going all in, Scott, for the rest of your life, one day at a time, that there's no more drinking. You walk this way with God and us. I said, I'm in. And I got on my knees with John. I got off my knees after saying this prayer. I didn't feel any better. You know, I mean, I felt worse. But I was better. It seems to be a theme of my sobriety even today. And he told me to write a four-step out of the big book, and I drug my feet for a couple weeks. And he said to me, Scott, you know, how you doing with that fourth? And I'm doing all right, you know. I didn't have anything down. He said, Scott, I'm going to set a date to make it easier for you. And don't forget what you did in the third step. Ask God for help. Say a prayer. And I literally sat on my mother and father's dining room table as that date was approaching, right? And I said, God, this does not look like a good idea to me. But if it is, I ask you for the courage to write. And I put my pen on the paper and you hear it. You hear about it. The magic pen or magic pencil didn't stop. It wrote by itself for 2 hours and it came out. And I called John. I said, John, let's do that fifth step tomorrow. And he laughed. Right? Much like in our history when it tells us that Bill and Bob laughed because when Bill D says, I'm a goner, you can't help me, because he knew the power of God. He knew what would happen if I asked. That was given to me, and I wrote it. And he said, no, we'll stick with Saturday, Scott. And I went into the parking lot of my home group, and he wasn't there yet. And something told me, this is not a good idea. Get out of here. And something told me, no, stay. And I went into the park with my sponsor and God, and I got spiritually naked. I got vulnerable. I was defenseless, unprotected. I left nothing out that I could think of. And as I'm in that park with my sponsor, he started to point out things to me that I could never see on my own. I let another man show me the truth about me for the first time in my life. And I could tell you all kinds of things about what he showed me in this fifth step. Well, here's what happened for me that I really remember is he showed me how, he said, Scott, why would people want to be around you? Why would you feel connected to them and they felt connected to you and they couldn't wait till you came back and were a part of, you know, them? I said, I don't know, maybe if I'm funny or something. He said, no, how about if you're honest? And as I looked over my fourth step with him, man, I lied my whole life. I exaggerated since I was a kid, that made stories up, trying to gain your approval or to feel better than you, you know. And he said, Scott, if you want a life where booze doesn't show up, and you want a life where you feel connected to people, you got to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are the opposite of your character defects, one day at a time with God's help. You got to pray for that. And we had a long talk in that park about all kinds of things, but that's what hit me. And on the way out of that park, he said, Scott, I'm your sponsor, but I'm a human being. I'm fallible. God is all-powerful, infinite knowledge and wisdom. He said, that's the most important relationship you have. And Sam Shoemaker talks about it in our history when he advises Bill Wilson what to do in sponsorship. Sam said, when you see the man with the problem, put his hand in the hand of him who has all the answers. Then go home. Don't stick around and play God. My sponsor put my dependence in its proper place. Now, I know I need you today, but ultimately my dependence is on my Creator. And he sent me home with that. And I go home and I reflect on the fifth step. And for me, you know, as I'm reflecting, somewhere in that hour, in an instant, I want to try to describe what's really ineffable. I felt God's love and forgiveness wash over me. The shame melted away. I haven't felt shame since. I knew he forgave me. My God forgave me. My Creator forgave me. Now, I have more work to do with the world, and I still do today, but I knew I had a clean slate with my God because I started to take responsibility in the park with him and my sponsor. And this peace came into me that hasn't left me since, no matter what happens in life, and I've been through the ups and the downs, right? And in that moment, too, the alcohol problem went away from me, and I haven't wanted to drink since. Now, up until that point, if you told me I could have a few beers and like get away with it, like really get away with it, mean I could have 8 or 9 and cut it off and just feel the butt, I would have been all over that if I could drink. It repulsed me to think of that. See, because the alcohol and God, the power, they can't coexist. And I had God in me. And here's the fifth step promise coming true in my life. As I leave that hour, and I go to my home group that night, and I'm looking at my friend Elena's eyes, who's still sober, by the way, today. And I'm looking at her, and I realize that for the first time in my life, I was in another human being's eyes, and I didn't want to leave. See, I stare at your shoes normally. If I have to look in your eyes, I'm uncomfortable. Not that night. I was clean. And something else really important happened to me that night is I took this man named Bill home. Bill is schizophrenic. And Bill doesn't dress like me. Bill doesn't bathe regularly. Bill gets picked on his whole life. But my mother and father showed me how to help the less fortunate. My mother shared her gifts with the less fortunate. Like the kids over at my mother's house from her kindergarten, like she was a kindergarten teacher. To this day, she's still, they've got 30, 40-year-olds that still she has relationships with. The ones that came over are the ones that had nothing. The ones that lived in the projects, the ones that had no parents or the ones out, they're the ones that were in my parents' house sharing my mother's swimming pool and my other gifts. So I knew how to help the less fortunate. So for 6 months in AA, I could take Bill to a meeting or buy him a coffee or lunch or sit next to him in a meeting and say, hey, how you doing, bud? You doing all right today? Good. You know, how, share, but I could do that for Bill. But I had nothing real in the way of our program to offer Bill because I wasn't taking your 12 steps. But that night, I had something extra. I had taken your fifth step. So on the way home, I said, Bill, do you have a sponsor? And I said that to Bill because I wanted him to experience what I did earlier in the day. And he said, yeah, you. And I said, I'll take you as far as I can, Bill. And the next day, we were looking at the first three steps. And with my little bit of experience, I'm fumbling through that. And not too long after that, Bill's afraid to write his fourth. And I say to Bill, I'm going to set a date. And don't forget what you did in the third. Say a prayer. Bill writes his fourth step. And I end up in a park with Bill, and I listen to his fifth step. And as you guys know, what an honor that is to listen to another man's fifth step. And as I listened to Bill's fifth step that day, tears came rolling down my cheeks, but these were different tears. For the first time in my life, I was unconditionally in love with that man, with another human being. You know, it was him. And from that moment to this moment, it's been my primary purpose. It's the reason why I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill and Bob talk about a vision. Bill talks about a vision for you. He says, although he knows he needs meetings and to do all the stuff we do to stay sober, that motive becomes secondary. It's transcended by the new motive. How I feel when I'm of use to others, the happiness and usefulness. Like, I never had a purpose. That day, right, the curse of alcoholism became the gift of alcoholism. And it's why I keep coming back. And here's what happened from having a guy right there behind me. I ran out. See, I ran out before I met Bill, or before I started to take Bill, before we started taking steps together. I ran out and I made all my amends, the easy ones, you know. And for me, the financial ones were easy. Well, it was like a business transaction. I took $500 from you. I owe you $500, and I understood how that. For victory over alcohol, that was my responsibility. I understood that. So I drove around for 2 years in $500 cars. I bought off the long-timers. 86 Mercury Lynx with push-button radio with no heat and a roof. And I'm a year sober, and I'm making financial amends, driving my home group with a couple guys. And I'm here to tell you my happiness has never been eclipsed since that day, no matter what material stuff has been given to me. But I'm afraid to make the real amends, like the real one, like my brother. My mother, my father, who I robbed, he doesn't know it, who I'm living with, my grandmother, like all these. But I had Bill catching up to me, man. I had him on his eight-step list. So I cared enough about Bill to stay one step ahead of Bill. And I literally did what the eight-step tells us to do. I prayed for the willingness. And I prayed for the willingness. Man, I prayed for the willingness. And the courage was given me one day, call your brother. I picked up the phone. And I called my brother, and I set up this date. I went out and I sat with my brother, and I started to cry like a baby. And I don't know if he knew what was going on, And I owned the way I treated him, and I took responsibility for it. And he stood up and said, I forgive you. I understand what those things are about. I said, I don't know how you don't hate me. And he said, Scott, I don't know if I could ever be as honest as you were right there. And that day I drove home. From my brother's house, on that ride home, half-hour ride home, I realized that I had a relationship with my brother for the first time. I hadn't been drinking or hurting him for many months, 7 or 8 months, whatever it was, but I didn't have a relationship with him until I did that. So much so that a few months later, my brother asked me to take him through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not an alcoholic. And we sat down. I told you I'm not any kind of a student. He would give me a history lesson. He's a history teacher. My whole family are teachers. And I started to get a history lesson from him, and I learned the history of the world from him, and I started taking him through the history of AA, which he loves, and we started doing the steps together, and I ended up in it, right where I made that direct amends in his house in Center City, Philly. I listened to his fourth step, and we did a fifth, and what a joke his fourth step was, Like he had his wife sometimes annoys him, he had a couple names on there, So we looked at it from an entirely different angle, He saw how he was inconsiderate, selfish. But there was one name on there that he harmed. One person in his life he could think that he really harmed. Sarah, his ex-girlfriend from 12 years prior, from North Jersey, that he cheated on and left her abruptly, always felt guilty about that. Very uncharacteristic of him. I said, Will, you better put that on your eight-step list, and someday you got to make it right. I didn't tell him to go find her. He's not an alcoholic. He's not going to drink and die if he doesn't. But I said, someday, you got to make it right. I don't know how many, 3, 4 months go by, I get a text message. Ran into Sarah at the Austin airport. Made amends incredible. I get on the phone with my brother. He goes, Scott, you're not going to believe this. He was in Texas visiting my sister. His flight gets delayed. He's walking through the airport. He locks eyes with Sarah, the one person on his ASAP list. She was with her brother. He was with his wife. They go to the bathroom at the same time. He was prepared to do what he had to do. He made the amends. He said it was the greatest experience he ever had. He called my mother and said he physically felt different when he did it. My brother, not too long after, moved to New Zealand. I showed my brother how we live in 10, 11, 12. Because to me, this is not a mechanics. This is a dance with God or a way of life. I showed him how we live in 10, 11, 12. He moved to New Zealand. He had his son. I got to fly to meet my nephew for the first time. And with my mom, sister, and aunt, and would take a ride alone. He says, yeah, I set up an amends for next week. He's like, the way I reacted to my sister-in-law just wasn't right. I saw how, my character, I'm like, this guy, he goes, I see how it's going to affect the relationship with my son and me and my wife. And I'm like, this guy's working the program faster than I am. You know what I mean? Like, it's enriching his life and those around him, right? And isn't that's what this is all about, right? You told me to go be a grandson. I never was, ever. Didn't care about my grandmother. Didn't show up in her life. She's 86 years old with a walker. I should start in the senior home. I start playing card games with her. I don't really like these games, but I'm spending time with her, letting her get to know me. That's all they want, right? Your mother, your father. I find all they want is your time, and they want to know you. We'll get to know you. I start to ask her questions. What do you like to do? What are your hobbies? She liked to go to Atlantic City, right? Like to gamble. She liked to spend all day there, right? But it's $20 she'd spend, right? So I'd take her. I'm not a big gambler. I'd go there, and I would bring spiritual books, you know, and I would read them. And she'd be like, can we stay another hour? I'm like, sure, Grandma. And I would take her to these maybe once or twice a month, you know. I'm self-employed at times, so I could take a day off on a Wednesday when she wants to go, spend the whole day. And on one of these trips on the way home, I said to her, Grandma, if you hit big, what would you do? She said, I know exactly what I would do. I would hire a driver to take me up to New England before I was born and raised, but I know it will never happen. Now, I said, I got home, and when, since she told me that, I started to think, like, I want to do this with her someday. I told you I was making my financial amends, and a funny thing happens when you make your financial amends, and we don't do it for this reason, but what happens is you can actually keep money, and it can grow because you've balanced the books in the spiritual sense financially. I'm not working from a deficit. Money's accumulating because of this. And I called my grandmother up and I said, Grandma, remember that trip we were talking about? She said, what trip? I said, the one in New England. She said, I remember. I said, I want to do it with you. She's like, what do you mean? I said, I want to do it with you. She said, Scott, I'm old with a walker. You would have no fun. I would need my own room. I don't have any money. I said, I know all that. I want to do it with you. And I had to beg her. And she let me. And I picked my 86-year-old grandmother up and put her in my Pathfinder. At the time, I graduated now to like a 5-year-old Nissan Pathfinder. I'm still making amends. And 8 days up in New England. First day her in Lisbon, New Hampshire, where she was born and raised, her 91-year-old brother, 84-year-old sister. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, spent the whole day together, you know, telling stories. Next day was my favorite day. Her 86-year-old best friend in the world, they never thought they'd see each other again. They were laughing and crying. I was laughing and crying. I took her to the field she used to run and play, where she had her first kiss, the church she was a part of, the school she went to. I mean, we had a blast. We even stopped at a nudist colony in Massachusetts on the way home. You know? She wanted to go in, you know, take pics. She lived life to the fullest. I think I told her I liked this trip a little too much because she asked me to take her to Wisconsin the following year, you know. And we get home from that trip, and my grandmother falls ill, and she passes away. She had 7 children. One of being my mother, and all of them came up to me and said to me, Scott, from the moment she got back to the day she died, all she wanted to do was talk about that trip, all the fun she had, and break out the photo album, show us the photos. She even waited for, and they asked me to say the last words at her funeral. Now, not too long before that, I wasn't allowed around the family, you know what I mean? Or they looked at me and didn't trust me. And now they gave me the honor of saying the last word at my grandmother's funeral. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for allowing me to be a part of my grandmother's last wish on earth. And that is my favorite trip I have ever been on. The dreams of travel for me have come true, as they do in here. But it's not way to go, Scott. It's way to go, God, and way to go, Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand that. Every day I'm on my knees personally. I thank my God. I say, thank you for everything you've given me. And help me give it all away in the glory of your name, not mine. Right, and our founders tell us the 11-step morning prayer meditation is the most important thing we do in here. I understand that. And I'm not perfect at it, but I know how important that is. Right? And these dreams come true for me, and I end up in the last 10, 12 years in 60 plus countries, six continents. I never left my hometown, never left the Barstool before I came here and met you guys. 95% of my travel, you know, as we're discussing today, you know, has been inside Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether I'm at a conference, or I'm at a workshop, or I am meet somebody at the international convention, which I've been to three and two, and next time I go to their country, they have me in their home, and I get to reciprocate and have them in my home. I got people from all over the world that come visit me. I take them to my home group. I show them Philadelphia, my fellowship that I created, that has grown up around me, and it's amazing. I'm not alone. You know, I got friends in Australia. We were talking whose kids call me Uncle Scott. You know. That's how many times I've been there or seen them in different places, in Akron, in Founders Day, internationals, right? In their home. They've been to my home, right? I learned how to surf in Waikiki at the Hawaii Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous a year sober. With tears in my eyes at 4 a.m. on a volcano with 300 alcoholics, sun comes over the horizon, and we break in the Lord's Prayer, and I'm crying like a baby. How did I get there? Nothing to do with me. Virtually homeless when I got here. At 5 years of sobriety, I'm in Thailand at the Thailand Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous with two of my best mates who never left Philly themselves, and we're traveling in Southeast Asia for a convention. It's the reason why we went. Learn how to ride elephants in Laos. You know? Learn how to surf in scuba dive in Indonesia at the Bali roundup of Alcoholics Anonymous with some friends that we talked about, right? With 10 of my mentors from all over the world. Right? One of them says, why don't you get certified? You know, it's amazing. I do it, and now I've been diving all over the world. Right? But at a convention. I learned how to ride camels in the Sahara Desert. Because you know what words I've heard since I got here? I've heard these words 9 times. That I never heard these words. My ears never heard these words before I got here. Scott, would you be the best man at my wedding? 5 times my ears have heard these words that I never heard before I got here. Would you be the godfather of my son? And my friend Spiritual Pete, who he's back. He was sober about 8-9 years and as active as I was. And he let other things get in the way, and he picked up. And it was many years of in the hospital. He's back about 6-7 months now, but he's not the same guy. I'll tell you what, man. Anyway, when he was sober, he met a girl from Moldova. He never left Philly. Now he meets his wife from a different country. They have a baby, and the ceremony is in Portugal, right? And he asked family and friends to go. I'm the only one that showed up. He couldn't express to me how much that meant to him. And I was the godfather of little Pete. I still am. And oh my God, these Moldovans, the ceremony they have is like incredible. Like they throw the baby around like on a blanket and you catch him, you know what I mean? I'm like go little spiral with little Pete, you know? It's amazing, the ceremony. But before I do that, I go down because I've always wanted to go to Africa. And if you fly into Lisbon, if you fly into Madrid, you can go down into Spain, and it's only like an hour ferry ride to Morocco. And now I'm going through a tough time. This has happened to me all through my sobriety. When I'm in a tough time, emotionally broken, the trials and tribulations of life and the hard times our book promises that I've gone through. So it's been my time in a barrel for some little things, but they were painful for me. And I was going through one of those. He was supposed to go with me. He didn't. So I'm alone in Morocco. I'm in the Sahara Desert alone with nomads, sleeping under stars, you know, camp with camels for 3 days, and I'm in pain, right? First day in, though, I end up in a little like resting area for water. And I'm drinking, and this Moroccan man, baby, and his wife comes through. They get off, they drink water. We have a conversation. I always talk about AA when it's appropriate. Always talk about AA because I don't have life without it. And it was appropriate. I start bringing up, you know, and he starts bringing up, and what are you talking about? She's like, is this like a change in, like a shift in consciousness thing? I said, yeah, it is. He's like, what is this thing? I said, he says, I can't stop drinking. I can go 2 months without drink, and I drink again, and I can't stop. It's killing my wife and my baby. They don't have AA over there. He's never even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to take this man through the first 3 steps, and he gets it, and we exchange emails. Now, I think I'm going to that desert to be adventurous, and God says, I'm going to use you. But God also knows I was going through a hard time. That happens to me, oh, my God, so many times when I'm here. I came in, it blows my mind. blows my mind. And my life takes off as it sounds, and it becomes abundant, which is okay, because I have no fear of economic. I don't have economic security. I have nothing, or I have everything. I'll be okay because it's all God's, right? And I know who's doing this and whose it is, and I'm a steward of it. But I also start to really, life shows up for me at 8 years of sobriety. I end up in a fetal position with a broken heart. The girl I wanted, after, you know, my heart was all the way in, I had to walk away, and it crushed me. And at the same time that happened, my right-hand man in business for 4 years, every day with me, told me he was leaving, threw him a big party, a couple hundred people thanking him for his service. He cried on my shoulder that night. I didn't know why he was crying. I thought he was scared, or was I not good enough to you? I don't know. He didn't want to answer. The next day, I found out why he was crying. Got into my QuickBooks system. He took everything, and he's been taken for over a year from me and put me into debt. And I was bankrupt and brokenhearted at the same time. And I'm telling you that, first of all, the heartbreak was worse, but those two things, I couldn't move. I was paralyzed for like a day and a half. I couldn't even look at my computer. I couldn't imagine picking up the pieces. But I'm here to tell you that I let you guys carry me. I let you guys carry me. And my sponsor taught me how to pray. And that, don't take away the pain. Just let me know you're here with me. Right? And I'm here to tell you that I came out of that. Also, in that, I was able to not hate that guy. Like when I haven't seen him since. If he walked in his door, I wouldn't let him hold my wallet. Right? But I would shake his hand and hug him. I can't imagine how that must feel. I don't think he's sober. I hear stories, but I haven't seen him since. It's been, I don't know how many years now, 6 years. But that guy, I have no ill will towards him because of hanging in here, not giving up on the disciplines, right? I've had resentment. I've had one for 2 years that I had to keep praying and praying and praying. Finally, I saw my part in it with the help of you when I was ready. And I went and I owned that and I got free so that when this happened, I was able to not hate him for 2 years like I did the other guy who I got in the business with and I think robbed me, you know? And I came out of this thing and you guys carried me. I learned so much about traditional one in my life and in my business, right? I don't have to be the leader. I can say I learned about recovery too. I mean, I thought I like knew it all and I was like some guru. And I learned and I learned that at 8 years of sobriety, or 10 years or 15, whatever, like this year probably, this last year here was probably my hardest like 6 and 7 year there is. I mean, like for me to say I'm afraid, you know, or I feel rejected. You know, my sponsor said that is recovery, Scott. That is where you're at. You talk about that, be honest with that. And I learned so much and you guys carried me right out of that thing and so much happened, you know, out of that. But when that thing all happened, man, as soon as that day happened, when it was right, it was the same. It was one day, the next day, heartbreak, and then boom, he robbed me and he left. And this new guy showed up in my life, right? Who had been trying to get sober for years and years, all over the place, and here he is. And I had all the time in the world to give him. You know, I didn't have a girlfriend now. I didn't have a real business. I couldn't imagine that thing coming back together. And he was with me all day long. All day long. And this guy started to get sober, started to clean up. He was in jail most of his life. He was 29. I was 29 when I got sober. Started to help him get teeth at the dentist. You know, he didn't have teeth. He didn't have a driver's license ever. I helped him with the permit, helped him with the license. He's cleaning up. He started at me and is still thriving in our area, you know. And he starts to sponsor guys and all this. And I remember thinking, man, I remember thinking, that's why the girl left and the business went away, because he needed me. Like, he needed all of me. And then I realized I had it backwards, that I needed him. And that in the darkest time of my sobriety to date, at 8 years of sobriety, whatever it was, God put a new guy in my life to take my mind off of me, to really remind me what this thing is really about, right? And he carried me right through that. And guess what? That business did come back. And because that guy left, and even though all the money went away, I can't tell you how exponentially it came back and people in my life came around into that business that wouldn't be there that I love working with today. All right? I'll tell you a quick story. And what I think AA is all about, it's the essence of AA for me. I hope it never changes. I was a few years sober in my home group. And I heard this guy sharing that he was struggling with a drink at 8 months of sobriety. His name is Haywood. And after the meeting, I went up to him and said, "Haywood, I heard what you were saying. I have answers if you want them. I don't push this down anyone's throat. I don't preach. I used to. I don't do it anymore. But I'll walk with you if you want it, and I will encourage you, and let's go if you want it." And he had to go. His ride was leaving, and I gave him my number, and he walked out the door. And I told him, "We have a Monday night meeting I'd like you to go to." And on Monday came, and he called me. He said, "Scott, it's Haywood. I want to go to that meeting." He goes, "You didn't think I was going to call you, did you?" I said, "I wasn't sure, but I'm glad you did." He goes, "I want to go." I picked him up. And I take them to the meeting, 200-300 people, a step a week out of the big book, breaking it down, experience, highlighters, pens. We did this for 12 years in the high school that I actually went to and got in all kinds of trouble. And after the meeting, you know, he says, "Scott, where was that? I love that." I said, that's the big book coming alive. He goes, "I love that." And on the way home, he goes, "Would you sponsor me?" I said, "I'd be honored to. Hey, what?" I said, "Let's start the steps on Wednesday." It was Monday night. He said, "Okay." And he tells me I almost drank over the weekend. His check came in on Friday. He had $800 pacing back and forth in his apartment, wanting to drink, but remembered that meeting and wanted to go. So he didn't drink. I said, "Whoa, we better start the step sooner, buddy." So it was late. We talked a little bit. I said, "Tomorrow at noon, meet me at the grade 11 down group." I get in there a little early. Here he comes bouncing in. He's looking around. He sees me. He's lighting up, smiling. Comes over, sitting next to me. We sit through the meeting. Afterwards, we go out to lunch. He tells me his whole life story. Guy's been through things I've never had to encounter. I come from there was no abuse, no sexual stuff in my family, nothing. Him, different story. And I just listened to him. Took him into my home. Back then, it will take me probably 2-3 hours for the little history, 1, 2, and 3. I've since changed. I don't know how long it takes now. But it could be that. It could be, you know, who knows. But back then, it was like boom, boom, boom. But anyway, we're 5 hours in. He can't admit he's powerless. And I'm in the doctor's opinion. I'm in Bill's story. I'm in their solution. We acknowledge it's more about. I'm in it all, pulling it out, all the bullet points. He can't admit it. I had a big book commitment that night. I had to go. He couldn't go. I'm on the way. I said, I got to get you home. 20-minute ride home. On the way home, I use another example because when I'm in here, I pay attention. And I get something from you or you or you, and I don't know when it's going to come out and be useful. And I use an example that I heard my friend Chris B., one of my mentors, say. He goes, "I see it. I'm powerless. I see it." Right? Start talking about step 2. How can it be a God, Scott? How can it be a God when all these horrible things happen? I said, "Well, maybe that wasn't God. Hey, well, maybe that was God, people's self-will." "All right, maybe," he says. Done. Start talking about step 3. I get to his front door. We're in the book. You know, we're looking at the prayer, the principles of it, saying the prayer together. Give him the book. He doesn't have one. He goes up to his door. I pull all here. "Scott!" I look over, he's at his front door with the hand on the door, and my people goes, "Thank you." I said, "You're welcome, bud." And I drove off. And I got a call from his roommate the next day. It says, "Scott Haywood passed away in his sleep last night. He died of cardiac arrest, natural causes." He says, "I got to tell you something, though. I've been living with this guy for 12 years. I've never seen him this happy. He came home last night talking about how he loves his sponsor, how he loves the group you took him to, how he can't wait to go to the B.B. King concert with you, because I invited him to the B.B. King concert with my mother and me. We were going. And he told me how much he loved B.B. King in that conversation, 5 hours in my house." At my house, also, so a tear, when he told me this, I was really upset. I was shocked, and I was saddened. I thought he got robbed for a minute there of all we get in here when we embrace all these steps. Then I realized, wait a minute, I was just given a gift, you know? That last hours of this man's life, I got to be kind to him. I got to buy him a meal, which he would say, "No one ever bought me a meal." He said that to me. I'm like, "What do you mean? It's a cheeseburger and fries." I got to listen to him when he talked to me about his problems. I got to pray with him and surrender to his God with him. I called my sponsor up, John Bragg at the time, and said, "John, I got to thank you for what you gave me. I'm going to tell you what just happened." He says, "Scott, I don't know if you will ever have a more powerful experience than that." It's exactly what that man needed to go on from here. Right? Now, when Haywood was sharing in that meeting about how he wanted to drink, I could have very easily said something like, "Don't drink, play the tapes, keep it green," or all, which are good things. But you gave me way more to offer that guy. Or I could have turned around and went about my busy life, because my life is very busy. But it wasn't busy when I got here. You gave me a busy life, right? So I had something real to offer that man a real answer. And I thank my sponsor for that. And in that time while we were sharing in my house, he kept saying this line that the earth will be yours and everything that's in it. But what's more is you'll be a man, my son. I said, what's this thing you're repeating? He goes, it's a poem by Kipling called If. Now, I never heard of it, and I was into spiritual things at that point, so I went and Googled it. Beautiful poem, right? That poem hangs, is framed above my office, and it helps me more than anything. I continue to be in service, have a job in my home group, be in service in AA, anywhere I can, go to conferences, go to institutions, hospitals, sponsor, be honored to have guys I can sponsor, have a sponsor, right? All this stuff, learn our study our history, study our tradition. Man, but that prayer has comforted me more in my hard times than anything. I learn more about it, like I do these steps every day. You know, and I was at a Vegas conference right after this happened, and the lady was speaking, and it wasn't the state line, it was the Las Vegas roundup or whatever, and she said, I used to think that I should live every day like it's my last day on earth. I don't think that anymore. I think I should live every day like it's your last day on earth. And the significance of Haywood hit me and what we're trying to do here, see, because booze, as good as it felt, never allowed me to cry tears of joy, right? But when I am giving to you, or I'm serving something greater than me, when I am not thinking about me, I'm thinking about you, man, that feeling is incredible. I had it wrong my whole life. I had it wrong my whole life, right? So, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I just hope tomorrow I can come back and be a better member than I was today. I hope the people, the guys up there and girls, women up there that had anything to do with this gift getting in my heart, you know, and I can name them, most of them, because I study our history, you know, are saying that kid Scott down there is doing a pretty good job with the gift we left him. So thank you so much.
All right.